Ready now? Good evening, everyone. This is the December 18th, 2018 meeting of the Kitsap County Planning Commission. I am filling in temporarily for Chair Buskirk, who is, we believe, en route, but is running a little bit late due to the weather and the tornado.
We have traffic.
Okay. And the traffic. We're starting a little bit late, so we apologize. We start the meeting with introductions. If you want to start, please.
Jim Swenson, Stormy, South Kitsap.
Rich Shattuck, Central Kitsap.
Joe Phillips, North Kitsap.
Tom Nevins, North Kitsap.
Kim Allen, South Kitsap. Okay. We are going to move approval of the minutes to our next meeting because we are short a few folks here, and I'm not sure what the composition was between the last meeting and now as to who was there. So why don't we just be safe and move it to the first meeting of next year?
Yeah.
Do we have a motion?
Move to delay approval of the minutes till next.
I'll second.
Okay. Any discussion? All those in favor signify by raising your hand. Any opposed? Passes without opposition. All right. Moving on to item D for our work study. This is a presentation by Darren Gurney and members of the wireless industry on the wireless code update. Before we get started, I need to make a disclosure. My daytime job is as a consultant to the wireless industry, doing presentations much like you will see this evening. I am a consultant for Verizon, and Verizon, Lila Vaga here, is here to present. That being said, having also been an elected official working for municipalities and a hearing examiner, I believe I can be fair and impartial, and unless there's some objection, would like to go forward and remain.
It brings an interesting question. I mean, you have more experience with this than I do about what I anticipate no problems, but I'm just seeing how, if in a close vote, it might be a problem if you were a deciding vote on an issue. I'm not sure that that is true, but.
Well, Commissioner, I take my lead actually here from Commissioner Shattuck, who represents developers and certainly appeared before me as a hearing examiner and is here making regulations and policy for developers. And I believe that he is a fair and impartial individual, and I intend to follow his lead. There's objection. And
no objection. I can even reflect that back on myself. I have certain prejudices that I bring to the table. I mean, there's no doubt about it. It still is a matter of whether anybody's vote is on an issue is critical to the situation. I don't know where to go with that. I don't think it's a problem in a work study to be here. I don't think it's a problem. I'm actually anticipating some of your information, background support that help us figure out what this is all about. But I don't know yet myself. So.
Commissioner Shattuck.
Just, I think actually the direction we have both in our bylaws and in just rules of ethics are that there is a specific potential problem on quasi-judicial matters when we're doing items that in which I represent an individual who's seeking a specific site amendment. At that point in time, I do think I need to make my interest known and make a decision as to whether I should recuse myself. I don't think we have those kinds of decisions or issues when we're dealing with legislative issues and providing recommendations.
I don't think we're going to be asked to do anything that's quasi-judicial on this.
Well, and the code amendment is not initiated by the wireless industry. This is initiated by staff. All right.
Okay.
Well, not hearing any objection, then I will continue to sit, and we'll turn over the floor to Mr. Gurney to introduce our presenters tonight.
Thank you. Is the microphone working well? hear me from here? So good evening, Commissioners. Darren Gurney with Department of Community Development. And tonight, as you mentioned, we are dealing with the wireless code update, the first of two work study meetings. This meeting is intended to provide background into wireless communications. We provided you the work plan after the last meeting so that you could review it in advance of this. You also have a hard copy in front of you tonight. We have a presentation from the carriers. It is not to be seen as formal testimony. It is not done for advocacy or lobbying purposes. This is purely for information purposes. And they are going to be required to submit comments, formal comments, through our public process in the public hearing section of the process.
Okay.
So this is working better.
Okay.
Much better. Thank you. So to continue, we are recording this meeting tonight through BCAT. There will be a link available on our website for the project. That is intended because we have many of these meetings that are work studies that are not easily attended by the public. We usually hear word at the public hearings that we weren't able to attend, and they have the questions that are typically answered in our work studies. So that is what is intended behind recording tonight's meeting.
Darren, is that an audio recording or a video?
It is video and audio. Okay, so it will capture the slides and the commentary behind those.
Thank you.
January 8th is going to be our second session. That will include review of the staff report and the proposed code. We are currently taking comments from our stakeholders to see if there are any revisions prior to that that information coming to you. Finally, we have a public hearing on the 22nd, and in February, starting the end of that process with the recommendation and findings of fact. So for our work plan, which you have received and you have a hard copy in front of you, the purpose of updating this code for wireless communications is to remain consistent with our federal standards. And you'll hear more about that later from Lisa Nickel, from the prosecutor, deputy prosecuting attorney. And the Federal Communication Commission rulings, the FCC, you'll hear that acronym pop up. Topics of the update include a full repeal of the section of wireless code in Title 17. There is a strikeout and replace or add in the definition section of Title 17, and a small piece in Title 21 that will be addressing nonconforming uses, but that is for our later meeting. But general topics, you go through definitions, what permits are required, the review times for those permits, general design standards across the board, and then there's some specific design standards regarding co-location facilities and tower versus non-tower, small cell versus macro sites, those things. The goals of this update, we want to ensure compatibility with the neighborhoods, but we also want to provide the ability to have that infrastructure for 5G technology, which is the new wave of technology coming forward. You'll see in future presentation that we're expecting from the FCC statements that we're supposed to get 10 to 100 times more facilities in the future to accomplish this. And I believe our presentation from the providers tonight is going to go into that detail. And we want to streamline review for that small cell technology with the aesthetic criteria that meets our communities. So without further ado, Lila Vaga, if I pronounced that correctly, she is going to be presenting for wireless technology, and she is from Verizon.
Thank you very much. And yes, that's how you pronounce my name. Most people get it wrong the first two or three times, so thank you. Appreciate that. My name is Leila Vaga. I am with Verizon Wireless Network Engineering Team. The bulk of the presentation I'm going to go through today was actually prepared for a presentation to the League of Oregon Cities a few months back. The reason why we're taking that approach is because staff specifically requested that it be a wider industry view of small cells. So this will be an abbreviated version of the presentation that I gave at that meeting.
Could you move the microphone a little closer?
Yes. Let's see. How's that? Better? Okay. First, here's some important information about industry contacts. So when addressing a wireless code, we found that there is really nothing that can replace getting feedback from both the wireless industry and also from the local utility pole owners, who are where we'll be attaching most of these to those utility poles. So highly encourage the city and, or excuse me, the county. I've done too many of these in cities lately. The county and really anybody that is updating their wireless code to pull together a detailed review of that code with the stakeholders. That would include city staff. It would also include the pole owner, so out here primarily Puget Sound Energy, and also representatives of the wireless industry. And these individuals have all offered to provide your feedback as well if you have questions that you know we can't answer or just want a broader industry viewpoint. So I'd like to take a minute and before we get into the League of Oregon Cities presentation and just tell you a little bit about what we're looking at right now in terms of trends in the wireless industry and why you're seeing new regulations out of the FCC and also why you're seeing the need to update code. It's largely because of the rampant growth in wireless data use that we've been seeing. So that first statistic up there, between 2010 and 2017, mobile data use increased by a volume of 39-fold. It's just the way that we're using technology is fundamentally different now than it's ever been before. So our cell phones are the remote controls of our lives, and things that were never wireless before are now becoming wireless. Those are things that range from my husband's sleep apnea machine to, you know, doorbells to kids' watches. It is throughout our society now, and our customers and your constituents are benefiting from that technology improving their lives in many, many ways. And, you know, it's our goal to really keep up with that demand and make sure that the network is there, the infrastructure is there, so that future innovations can take advantage of it and move us forward. 52% of American households are now wireless only, and most individuals who still have landlines have them for emergency purposes. So the paradigm of how we look at wireless technology has really changed. Wireless is our primary form of communication now, rather than just our emergency form. And then 13 connected devices in a household. This number seemed high to me until I started counting how many devices we have in our households, from Fitbits to the phone the kids play on to my friend has a smart doorbell that will show a picture when he approaches his house. More and more things are being connected, and that is just driving a change in how we use our wireless data. 94% of millennials have smartphones, and millennials are now anyone under the age of 37 years old. So that means that, you know, the vast majority of us are embracing this technology and moving forward, not just the newer generations, and for safety reasons. 80% of 911 calls now come from smartphones. And first responders utilize our services on a daily basis to do their job in their emergency response vehicles. And in addition to just making sure people have the conveniences, it's also important to make sure people have that safety net of knowing that when they call 911 from their phone, that it's going to work, the call's going to go through, and that they're going to be able to convey whatever information they need to in that process. So what's possible? A lot of what we're building now with both our enhancements to our 4G LTE coverage and capacity across the industry and also the introduction of 5G is targeted around making sure we've got fast, reliable wireless data connections. And that's to enable things like self-driving cars or virtual reality applications. And right now, a lot of those things are kind of far away. But a virtual reality application is something that can really improve worker safety and just how we live our lives. For example, imagine if instead of pulling out the book when it's time to change the oil in your car to find out exactly which part to unscrew, if you had that as a heads-up display so that you could see exactly what you're looking at side by side as you're working, Those are the kinds of applications that are being developed now that will ultimately utilize first advanced 4G and then 5G technology. And then, of course, a myriad of applications when it comes to public health and safety, and then real positive implications when it comes to reaching Vision Zero and avoiding traffic fatalities. We can really use data in ways that we've never been able to before, and all of those tools right on the wireless network to do that. So now I'm going to jump into this presentation. I will not hit on every slide. I'll skip through a few. This is designed to give you just an overview of what small cell is. So this is just more on the network evolution. So just an idea of how much faster 5G really is. 4G is about 100 megabits per second. 5G is 10 gigabits per second up-down speeds. So just much, much faster and can carry a much higher volume of traffic. But the signal doesn't travel as far. Skip past that one. So macro sites are the traditional way that we deploy wireless coverage. And macro sites are the sites that you're used to seeing now. So those are generally between 75 and about 150 feet tall. And they have between 6 and 8 panel antennas on them. And those panel antennas are between 6 and 8 feet tall, so fairly large. We measure that coverage on the order of miles. So you'd have sites on building tops, sites on hilltops, and those cover a large geographic area. Small cells are intended to add capacity where needed by having a lower power signal that is that sends out the signal on an order of a few hundred to a few thousand feet. And by limiting that signal and putting it closer to the end user, what you can do is you can add capacity without creating interference with the macro site network. So that's, in short, what small cells are. Macro sites are not going away. Macro sites will continue to be the backbone of our network. They are our primary method for deploying wireless coverage and capacity, and will continue to be so in the future. So as you're looking at this code, it's important to understand that the macro site regulation is just as important, if not more so, to Kitsap County than the small cell regulation.
Can we ask questions as we go?
Yes, please. Certainly, please.
So are the small cells on a network with the macro tower, or are they completely independent?
Excellent question. They each function as an independent facility. However, we deploy them in clusters, or for the Verizon industry term is polygons, so in groups of anywhere between 10 and 40 at a time. And while they don't interact directly with each other in the sense that if one goes down, the other one doesn't go down, they are designed so that the capacity improvement from one drop off where the capacity improvement from the next pick up. When it comes to components of the sites and how they interact with macro sites, they can be completely standalone from macro sites. However, often the computer unit, what we call a baseband unit, that actually controls what signals are going to that radio antenna combination, it's often housed at a nearby macro site facility to reduce the amount of equipment on the pole, but also to allow for better, more efficient communication so that the same signal gets sent a fewer number of times. Okay, differences between a macro and a small cell. So that's a macro site antenna next to a small cell antenna. We had one of our crew take a picture of this at our warehouse. Macro sites are typically very large. Small cells are anywhere between between 1 and 3, sometimes 4 panel antennas that you see, and they're about 2 feet high. By the FCC rules, they need to be under 3 cubic feet, so they're much, much smaller. And then there's just kind of a picture from AT&T about just relative scale. So that guy's a little bit tall in this one, but small cells are generally designed to go on existing infrastructure wherever possible. So they would go on existing wood utility poles or existing light standards. The target height range ranges from 20 to 40 feet. Sometimes we do need to deploy them higher, but that's not because of the wireless carrier's need. It's because of the safety restrictions that are in place on wood utility poles or other light standard poles. So, for example, we have to comply with National Electric Safety Code and with Puget Sound Energy Standards. So on Puget Sound Energy poles, we have to go pole top with those installations because that's a policy of Puget Sound Energy. So that means that there are certain clearance requirements we may need to maintain, and sometimes that pushes us up above our target height. And we have different different tools that we use to compensate for that. One of those is that using that panel antenna as opposed to more of an omnidirectional canister antenna, because then we can tilt them down to get closer to our target range.
So do you have to make the poles taller then?
We do often have to make the poles taller. So I'll get to a slide fairly soon here with the diagram of the site. But yes, often with utility poles, it is a pole replacement. Almost always, we're finding on average about 80% of the time, higher in some cases, we are having to replace the pole just because of the conditions of the poles and the aging infrastructure. The poles do need to be taller if we need to meet those clearance requirements, because most poles are not built for that today. And then also, the pole owner will sometimes increase the height of the poles when we come to them with our project, because they need additional space for their uses in other parts of the pole. So with the growth in wireless data usage, we're also seeing more wire lines being strung for fiber and other communication services. It's not uncommon for a pole owner to need more space in the communication space on the pole. So there are several factors that can impact that pole height. That's another critical reason why having Puget Sound Energy or other pole owners at the table to review the code in the code development process is important.
Is co-location still a possibility with these 5G antennas on smaller poles?
Co-location is a challenge. In certain places, like dense urban areas, it's sometimes possible. But the challenges that we have are that the different carriers each use different frequencies licensed by the FCC. And those signals travel to different ranges. We also have the challenge that different carriers have different locations where they need that additional capacity. So Verizon's macro sites are not all in the same place as our competitors. Each different carrier has different spaces in their network where they need that additional capacity, and we're not finding a lot of overlap there. We're also finding where there is overlap, Verizon may need its nodes 400 feet apart, whereas AT&T needs 200, or T-Mobile might need 600. And those are just numbers out of thin air, but to illustrate the point. For that reason, co-location is not often feasible. We also have the challenge that many pole owners, including Puget Sound Energy, only allow one carrier per pole, and that's because of concerns about getting too much equipment on any one given pole and the ability to maintain those safety and clearance standards if you do have more than one carrier on a single pole. Co-location also has the challenge that we're all going for a very narrow height range in that 20 to 40 feet. So once you start having multiple carriers, you start pushing up those heights, and pretty soon it becomes not workable for small cells because you get outside of the height range where we can compensate our equipment. So this is just a comparison of 4G, 5G, and macro sites and approximate ranges. So 5G is going to be much more powerful in terms of the amount of data and the speeds when compared to 4G. But it also, at this point, as far as we know, has a shorter range. So that means it will likely deploy in a small cell format. However, not exclusively. There will be instances where 5G would also be put on macro site facilities to serve the area immediately around those macro site facilities. But when you hear numbers about a dramatically larger number of facilities needed, it is largely in response to the fact that the 5G signals being, just the different frequency that carries a lot more data but doesn't carry it as far.
One other quick question. So we're in rural, yeah, that'll make sense in terms of the city, but we've got a lot of rural area here in Kitsap County, and so putting something every 200 to 750 feet apart seems top. So are we going to have 5G in cities and 4G in rural? Is that what we're going to end up with?
We are working on macro site solutions for 5G. That are I honestly don't think that anybody has a really great answer for that question just yet. Macro sites are certainly going to continue to be crucially important in Kitsap County. There are still a lot of places in the network in Kitsap County where we need much better 4G LTE coverage. Mm-hmm. Also, many of the smart cities, smart technologies, Internet of Tomorrow kind of solutions work very well on 4G, and do not need that additional capacity of 5G. Especially in more rural areas where you don't have the density of users. So for myself, I don't tend to look at it as 4G or 5G. There'll be 4G, 5G, 6G, 7G, whatever's coming down the line. It's all about improving that capacity and coverage of the data. So so as far as exactly how will 5G come to Kitsap County, I don't have that answer, and frankly, I don't think any carrier at this point has that answer. But what we do know is that we have a lot of work to do just improving wireless coverage and capacity in general here in Kitsap County. This is another macro versus small cell. One common misconception is that small cells are going to look like the macro sites that are already on wood utility poles. And I know that this is a very pretty example of a wood utility pole that is a macro site. There are many that are that do not look quite as good as that. But just wanted to show you the contrast of a small cell on a wood utility pole versus a macro site on a wood utility pole, so you can get a sense of the scale difference. Components of a small cell. Now we get into the real details. So essentially any cell site has three primary hardware components: antenna, radio, and baseband unit, or the baseband unit's the computer that sends the signal through the radio and antenna. Small cells, that baseband unit is housed at a hub facility or a nearby macro site, so it's not actually at the small cell. The components that we've got there, I think this is the laser pointer. So we've got antennas up here at the top. This is a 4G LTE deployment, so two panel antennas. Then there's conduit set off from the pole that carries the coaxial cable from the antennas down to the radio enclosure. That conduit is also needed to carry the power to the radio enclosure and also the fiber line to the radio enclosure. The radio enclosure is right here. That's where we put our radios, but also any other kind of equipment we might need. So if there's any transport equipment or anything like that, that goes in there. And then below that is a power disconnect. And that power disconnect is so that any utility worker that approaches that pole doesn't need to worry about understanding radio frequency safety in order to approach that pole. They can just turn it off, and then that we automatically get a notification at the National Operations Center, and then when they're done with their work, they can turn it back on. One important component to keep in mind is that fiber is crucial to small cells, and really to wireless in general. All of this wireless data eventually at some point gets put into a fiber optic connection and travels through wires back to our technical facilities. So each of these small cells will need new fiber for them to operate. And what we're finding is that there is just not an existing fiber infrastructure that can support them there today. So so it's important when you're considering your code to understand that that fiber piece is crucial, and that fiber is not often provided by the wireless carrier itself. Often it's a third party that the wireless carrier contracts with for that fiber. And that fiber provider will often be building for their own commercial business needs outside of what we contracted them for. So for me personally, we put a small cell facility into my neighborhood, Verizon did, and within a couple weeks I got a knock on my door from the fiber provider that I happen to know Verizon used for that installation, offering fiber to my home because they had built for that larger purpose. So for that reason, it's important that you keep permitting for the wireline side of the work going through the business as usual channels and working as a smooth independent process as opposed to tying those applications together. They're often not easy to tie together, and often there are more components of the fiber build than are directly related to the small cell. So here's a picture of a light standard installation. And so this is similar, just another opportunity to show you the components that we're looking at here. This is a different kind of antenna. It's a canister antenna. So right now, small cell antennas come in a couple of varieties. They're generally either, you know, more rectangular panel or more cylindrical, a cylinder antenna. And the cylinder antenna, we call it a faux omnidirectional antenna because it does send out signal in all directions, but it's actually comprised of multiple panel antennas inside that do that. Then we've got the radio enclosures here further down on the pole, and then the power disconnect. So same basic components. You'll notice there is not a large conduit with wires running down the side of this pole as there was with the wood pole. That's because often with light standards, you can internalize the wiring. However, in most cases, light standards also need to be replaced because many of our light poles are actually not designed with enough free space inside for those wires. So when you're talking small cells, you know, there will be quite a high number of pole replacements required. more on antenna variations. So there's just more look at panel versus canister antennas. They're all within the 3 cubic feet, and they vary widely by carrier, and there are different models and configurations coming out all the time. So flexibility is very important. This is a closer look at an AT&T canister antenna. And then this is a T-Mobile unified enclosure. So T-Mobile takes a slightly different approach with some of their small cell installations, where they put the radios and the antennas all in one box and put that entire box up on the pole as one unit. So that's something to consider in your code as well. Not all small cells will be radios on the bottom, antennas at the top. Some will have radios integrated with the antennas in the same enclosure. Some will be radios integrated into the same piece of equipment from the manufacturer. So that definition gets a little bit challenging. Generally, you know, account for a unified enclosure in design standards. T-Mobile certainly has been very vocal that they utilize these quite a bit. And I encourage you to think about how you want these to look with a lot of flexibility because of all this variation that we see from the industry.
Can't all the carriers use that same design?
Carriers cannot all use the same design. And that's because of the technical specifications of our networks. So, for example, Verizon is often deploying, especially in areas like Kitsap County, more of a suburban solution, more of a solution where we're using higher powered radios than you might find in a more urban site. Something like that would not fit nicely into this enclosure. Our radio frequency engineers design our projects specifically to meet the radio frequency needs and the capacity needs that we have in that particular area. And they get very specific about that. They give us an area of a few blocks sometimes a quarter mile, and say, you know, we need nodes every 800 feet in this area because we want to use this specific equipment to target this specific need with the specific frequency that will serve that best. So this particular solution, it's something that certainly T-Mobile has said they plan to deploy a lot. Verizon has looked at the different kinds ways of doing that, and we found that while it's workable for some applications, it's not workable for a lot of the things that we're trying to do with our different radios and our different antennas. Keep in mind, behind all the carriers are also various equipment manufacturers, all manufacturing different sizes and shapes of equipment to serve different frequencies and different specific range needs. So here are some pictures of utility pole installations. This is one of ours. This is our first project on Puget Sound Energy poles in Bellevue, and it's a 4G installation. We learned a lot from this pilot project, and frankly, it will always have a special place in my heart, this particular one. But this picture is an example of a neighborhood installation on a distribution pole. This is another one from that same installation. This was our very first project with Puget Sound Energy and their very first small cell installation. It was before Puget Sound Energy had implemented their most recent standards. So this installation would actually not be permitted under the current Puget Sound Energy standards. It would have to be above the neutral line, so above that line now, based on PSC's current standards and guidelines. This is a Portland area pole with a canister antenna above the lines. So that gives you more of an idea of what we're talking about when we're talking about above the lines on distribution poles. Also shows you a canister as opposed to the panel antennas. This is, I believe, Eugene, Oregon, and it's a canister that is side-mounted from the pole. So there's the canister antenna, that cylinder, on an arm that stands off from the pole to provide enough clearance so that the signal doesn't just hit the pole and bounce right back out. And then the similar conduit going down the pole to a radio enclosure. And then these are some similar installations from T-Mobile. So again, you see the antenna at the top, conduit carrying the wires down to a radio enclosure. Strand mounts. Strand mounts are the newest type of small cell. It's something that I think it's wise to account for in a code. At this point, at least speaking for Verizon only, I do not see a lot of more suburban and rural applications for strand mounts, but it's important to be aware of them in the context of what may be coming in the future. This is Verizon's first strand mount trial in Seattle. It's a small radio antenna combination unit right there, and on this right there, that little dot. And so these particular antennas, they are single frequency. They're not as powerful as the other antennas that you saw that were larger, and they don't have as wide a range. But the advantage of strand mounts is that they hang on the steel cable that the fiber runs along. So they have a much smaller visual impact and are very appropriate in dense urban settings where your coverage objective is truly street-level traffic. And then here's a T-Mobile strand mount setup so that you can kind of see the variation between the different carriers. And then another T-Mobile strand mount. And another T-Mobile strand mount. I forgot how many there were in there. And then finally, some light standard pictures. So these are pictures with a variety of different light standard configurations. When thinking about light standard design, it's important to think about how much you want the antennas to be seen versus hidden. And the counterpoint to that is how versatile you want them to be for future modifications versus how costly and difficult for future modifications. So the more you enclose an antenna in whatever configuration you're doing, the more you actually stealth it and screen it, the larger a bulk you get, but also the harder it is to change that out for the next improved technology when that comes along. So that's the case for both light standards and for wood poles. There's also the challenge that, at least to this point, most 5G equipment cannot be screened on the antenna space. So it can be screened to the extent that you enclose the cabling, but there are very few solutions to allow for that front of the antenna to be covered with anything. So here what you see, again, radio disconnect, antenna, wires inside the pole. This is a photo simulation of a very similar installation, radio box, disconnect, antenna. And then this is more of a, this photo simulation of more of a stealthed pole. So you see that you don't see a radio box or a power disconnect box, and the antenna is streamlined in the pole, but as you can see, it's a much larger pole. So just different aesthetic choices to be made there. And this is another one being installed, which reminds me, I forget if I mentioned already or not, most wireless installations, most small cell installations, the actual work on the pole to install them is a 1 to 2 day job. And the power company crews actually do all the installation work in the power line space. So usually the wireless carrier will install in the communication space, so put up the radio enclosure, and then it's the utility provider, so Puget Sound Energy, who installs above the neutral line, you know, in the space where the power lines actually are, or above that space. For light poles, it varies, and it's something that is generally worked out between the pole owner and the wireless carrier, but installation times are similar, 1 to 2 days. The fiber build is often the much larger piece of the installation process. Here's another pole with equipment internalized to the pole. This is an actual picture rather than a simulation. And then here's one in Nevada where you see a smaller antenna kind of sticking up the back and then the radio enclosure. This is a photo simulation we developed for the city of Kirkland, and it's a this is a use case in how sometimes getting too specific about the design of the pole can be a hindrance. In this particular case, the radio model that we had planned, Verizon had planned for this enclosure base, was discontinued by the manufacturer. So now this pole is in redesign, and we've learned that we need to be much more flexible for future modifications because we've had to throw this entire design out the window since it no longer can accommodate a radio that we can order. And then these are a couple other light standards that are local. Both of these are, or excuse me, the one on the right is not local, but light standards. The one on the left, that's a light standard we're developing for the city of Seattle. Notice it actually has 8 antennas on it. Each of those antennas is about 8 inches square. So it's an example of how sometimes more antennas can give you a better look than fewer antennas, depending on the size of those antennas. The one on the right is a pole that is mid-replacement, so it gives you the new pole next to the pole that is going to be removed. So you can see that there are a lot of details that could be worked into a decorative light standard design. And then here's a pole that we're working on developing for the city of Bellevue, Puget Sound Energy Pole. And this is in line with one of the Puget Sound Energy standard light poles that they are actually looking at using going forward. So again, the antenna on the top, we've got a radio right below it, and then a power disconnect a bit farther down the pole. And then some more exposed equipment on some light standards. And then this is what the T-Mobile Unified Enclosure looks like on a light standard. And then here's some more wireless-only poles. So a wireless-only pole is essentially the same as a light standard, but without the light. So we would utilize these in places where there are dark skies initiatives and street lights are not wanted, or where for whatever reason the municipality or the pole owners in the area did not feel it appropriate for us to install our facilities there, or for those places where all the utilities are undergrounded and there is no need or desire for above ground lighting, there is a need and desire for that wireless coverage and capacity. A couple more examples. One simulation on the left, and then an actual pole installation in a park on the right. And then these are some designs. I'll just go through these really quickly. The industry has been working together on some unified design standards for a few cities in the Pacific Northwest. Portland is one of those cities. And so these are some examples of photo simulations that were developed to illustrate what those might look like on the poles. So this is a standard that was developed that would meet all carriers' needs. There's a similar initiative going on right now in Bellevue to come up with design standards that are workable for the full industry. And certainly, I or any of the other industry contacts on that first slide can loop you into more details about that if you'd like them. So that's about all we've got, just more Portland pictures, which were a lot more relevant in the League of Oregon Cities than they are here, so I'm just going to skip past them. That's what I've got for you today. Any questions, I'm happy to answer them. This is a highly technical topic, and we really appreciate that staff and that the Planning Commission are seeking input from industry. We really appreciate you listening to our concerns and helping us to get a code that is workable for us to deploy.
Are there other industry representatives here tonight?
There are indeed. Sunny Osink is here tonight from Wireless Policy Group representing AT&T, and she can certainly answer any questions you have about that. Also, Sunny's an expert on macro site codes, so if you have any questions for her on those, I'm speaking for her, but I'm sure she'd be happy to answer them.
What are the electromagnetic radiation implications of 5G versus the old technology? I saw some of these antennas on poles that were very close to what looked like apartment buildings and that sort of thing.
Yeah, small cells are lower to the ground, and they are also lower power in terms of the radios. So the wireless industry is heavily regulated by the FCC when it comes to radio frequency emissions and health and safety. And it is common for us in the industry to do what we call non-ionizing energy reports, to run essentially the numbers to make sure that these are within those guidelines. And those guidelines are set by the FCC but are informed by the FDA, by OSHA, by a myriad of international health organizations that have studied this issue widely for many, many years, for the past 70, 80 years. Small cells are much lower power than a macro site. So whereas in a macro site facility, you have several large radios in a cabinet going to an 8-foot tall antenna, small cells radios range from 5 to 40 watts. So it's not putting out a whole lot of energy when you get to that antenna. 5G is similar to 4G in that respect. And there are standards for 5G that the FCC is developing and we are held to the same stringent health and safety standards by the FCC when it comes to 5G as we are to 4G and 3G and any other frequency that we use.
Thank you.
Yes, excuse me. I'm noticing that you have many cities listed here, and some of them are in our region. Mm-hmm. Is there any discussion about a regional decision or guideline on aesthetics and numbers and all of the things that you're interested in, renting poles and all that stuff?
I am not aware of any specific regional code template or regional regulation being considered. However, last year in 2017, 22 cities in Washington banded together and formed a consortium of cities to study this issue of wireless facilities and small cells specifically. Ogden Murphy Wallace headed that initiative. They're a legal firm that provides services to many of the cities and counties throughout Washington State. And they had many, many meetings with the various wireless carriers, presentations from, I believe, all the major carriers, as well as many of the infrastructure companies. So that might be Crown Castle or ExteNet or anybody who builds a pole for wireless carriers to locate on but is not a wireless carrier themselves. And they dove really deeply into this issue. And they did produce a model code at the end of that process. It was prior to the most recent FCC orders, but they have been updating that since then. That did include design standards and aesthetic guidelines that they had worked out in keeping with the state definition of small cell at that point. And so some really good best practices came out of that exercise, and it was very valuable for the carriers, most definitely, but I think also in terms of providing a unified understanding and some educational materials for municipalities in Washington. So, I'd encourage you to look into that. Ogden Murphy Wallace, the consortium of cities that looked into small cells in 2017, they did a lot of good work.
A couple of quick questions. It seems to me that this is a huge change in terms of land use planning. You're going to have areas that have 5G, which are going to naturally attract new technologies and groups that want that kind of 10 gigs rather than 100 megs. And so are we in an age where really the wireless company is going to drive some of our land use decisions, where you're going to say, geez, we're going to put 5G here for whatever reason, and boy, we as a community are just going to have to conform with that? Or are we in the industry looking at this in a way that say, no, community, you tell us where you want these kinds of industries, where you want this kind of infrastructure, are going to work with you? What's going to drive the decision on where 5G is going to be located versus not?
Yeah. So when we design our networks and make any decision about our projects, 5G, 4G, any kind, but especially when it comes to 5G, we're doing that based on the needs in our network and where we're seeing the highest demand in our network. There are teams of radio frequency engineers and system performance engineers that, in the old commercials, they were the drive testers, the can you hear me now guys, who are looking at computer modeling of current needs that they're, each of our antennas and radios provides information to our National Operations Center about how bogged down it actually is. So they're starting with that data, and then they're looking at predictive modeling based on where we think we're going to see more use. 5G, in its essence, is just faster and more capacity in the data. So at this point, I think that what you'll see is that just like any other improvement we make to our network, we target it for those areas that have the greatest need from a network perspective. However, you know, we are actively working with municipalities throughout the Pacific Northwest, throughout the nation, to make sure that the way that we deploy that is in keeping with the values of the communities that we're in. We are not looking at any kind of urban planning or any kind of urban planning or land use measures when it comes to where we place our sites. We do it based on the needs of our network and the needs of our customers and where there is a demand for that service. There are changes to how land use codes will operate in regard to wireless facilities when it comes to small cells, because they are inherently different. A small cell, as a small attachment to usually existing infrastructure in the right-of-way, is materially different from a 150-foot pole on private property on some acreage or on the top of a mountain, or large antennas on the rooftop of a building. So it's important to look at them differently from a regulatory perspective, because they are such different applications. But when it comes to where we plan to put these, it's driven by our business needs, and that's essentially it.
Whether just other quick follow-up, as I understand you again, you're saying, geez, we're not going to co-locate, and each carrier is going to have its own frequency. So if I'm in a community, what I'm going to expect is at least four different carriers having all of the infrastructure on that pole. So,
yeah, let me reiterate that in Kitsap County, I think we're a long way from a small cell from every carrier on every pole. There's still a lot of work to do on the macro site network to provide that overlying capacity, that really good deep capacity from our macro site network before needing the infill of the small cell networks. But to the point of multiple carriers, yes, there are multiple carriers, and we are not going to be using the same equipment. We're going to have different equipment, and that equipment will be coming into sometimes the same area, sometimes different areas. But it is conceivable that you'll have multiple carriers wanting to be in the same area, especially the more densely populated areas. And in that case, you may have multiple carriers where it's, you know, Verizon on one pole, then AT&T on the next, then T-Mobile on the third pole. That is a possibility in the future. In the short term, most of our capacity restrictions are not in exactly the same spots. So it's unlikely to be an immediate problem. But it is something that it's good to put thought to, that it's not just one carrier's deployment, that it's multi-carrier's deployments, and that each carrier is going to have its own specific needs. Sometimes that may result in a viable co-location, but often it won't.
Actually, I'd like to hear from Ms. Ossink about that, too, because she has an AT&T perspective on this. Get the balance.
Hi, my name is Sunny Ossink. I'm here on behalf of AT&T.
Well, I guess my question is just a follow-on to Commissioner Shattuck's. You know, we've heard about, you know, Verizon's plans for deployment, and is AT&T similar? Are you going to need to be in the same places?
Not always. I mean, there's, because in terms of, you look at a macro facility, sometimes we're on the same tower as like Verizon, but not always in terms of the same location either. So in terms of where our needs, sometimes it might overlap, but they're not always going to overlap in terms of where our customer base is required. Does that make sense?
Yeah, but just that, you know, I guess the point, you too are looking to deliver 5G to the county,
right,
as well.
Right.
This is kind of a strange point because I don't understand the technology, but about two decades ago, Kitsap Public Utilities District got very excited about fiber optic cable, and they, you know, got a law passed through the legislature that made it possible to do that. And some of that infrastructure has been in place. Are the carriers planning to use any of that infrastructure and perhaps amortize some of the cost of that, which is basically a taxpayer cost?
So the wireless carriers generally contract with third parties for the fiber build. Sometimes those get to be confusing relationships. Verizon, for one, will sometimes contract with the wireline arm of our own business, but we're still paying a market rate for that. It's unlikely, because of the stringent maintenance and reliability standards that we have for fiber, that we would individually contract with small fiber owners. However, our large fiber providers that we routinely do contract with often have agreements where they sublease fiber from other providers. So that would be a question more to target to the fiber providers themselves. When Verizon enters into a contract with a fiber provider, it's a large book of a contract. And because of all of this wireless data going to the fiber, we take our fiber very, very, very seriously and hold those fiber providers to very stringent penalties and requirements, having to do with the reliability of the speed of the service, but also things like if that service should be cut off and making sure that it's restored quickly and you know, that all possible resources are put to that. And those requirements are often too onerous for smaller fiber providers to meet. However, often large fiber providers will enter into agreements with smaller fiber providers to fill those gaps in their fiber network and take on that liability of providing Verizon with that assurance.
All right, thank you very much.
Thank you.
So with that information, we do have another presenter tonight. Lisa Nickel is presenting on some of the Federal Communications Commission rulings, and she has some slides as well.
Hi, thank you, commissioners. I'm Lisa Nickel, one of the prosecutors, deputy prosecutors in the, for Kitsap County, and I've been asked to provide you some background on the legal aspects of this. Because you will be looking at a code, but that code comes with some restrictions about what local governments can do. So I wanted to give you a little bit of the background. The last presentation focused a lot on the small wireless, but our code will be covering multiple aspects. So I'll go back to then 1996 when the Congress kind of opened up the Telecommunications Act and did a sweeping change. And it was mostly to, some places call it deregulation, but it was really an opening it up to competitors to make more people able to participate and provide telecommunications services. And so in doing so, Congress put some restrictions on local governments. The two that are most applicable here are Section 253 of Title 47 of the United States Code and 332. Starting with 253, that's kind of the first in the numerical order. It was called removal of barriers to entry so that more people can be providers. And it said that no regulation may prohibit or have the effect of prohibiting businesses from entering. So any of our regulations, we can't prohibit, and we can't do anything that makes it more difficult and prohibits them from entering. However, in subsection C, it says we can still manage our right-of-way. We just can't do it on a discriminatory basis, and we can charge fees, but they have to be fair and reasonable. Of course, Congress didn't really provide much guidance on those. In Section 332, they reiterated that we can't discriminate unreasonably between providers, but this is a functionally equivalent services, and that's essentially the same providers. And we also must act on a permit within a reasonable period of time, and no fleshing out of what that means. So in 2009, after some of court cases and a lot of other disputes, the FCC issued an order. They call it the shot clock order. It's essentially permit review times. And they determine what a reasonable period of time is, presumptively for new applications of new facilities, it's 150 days. For anything that's co-located, it's 90 days. These obviously are just presumptions. They can be rebutted with additional evidence. But the FCC determined that that was, if you met with these, you should be fine. But it's still only dealt with new towers and co-locations. In 2012, the Congress got involved again and carved out a portion of the co-location section and said that there's certain co-locations that are special and that they need extra help to be able to deploy. And so in the Middle Class Tax Relief and Job Creation Act of 2012, also known as the Spectrum Act, they said that local governments cannot deny, we must approve a request to install an eligible facility on an existing wireless tower or base station. Congress did define what an eligible facility is, essentially a co-location, removal, or replacement, so it's very broad. So we have that as a base. And then in 2014, the FCC got involved again and added definitions and some structure to the substantial modification portion. So where you're doing a co-location, it doesn't substantially modify, you get a 60-day review period. And backing up, the FCC order, because Congress had adopted the eligible facilities kind of definition but didn't do anything else, the FCC defined what an existing tower or base station was, what a substantial change is, and what co-location is. And essentially, I won't get into details of it now, but when you look at the code that will be before you next time, we moved or brought over those definitions. So some of those, they can be tweaked, but basically we're following federal law on this. Substantial change involves certain criteria on how much more height you can create or how much more width you can create or the number of cabinets you can install. There's also certain excavation and length of excavation details, and also stealth or concealment requirements. If you don't go against any of those, you're considered a non-substantial change, and you get faster review in the 60-day review. And then also, if you don't meet that time frame, it's deemed approved. There's some other details with that, but FCC really wanted these to go forward. There's a little bit of clarification from the 2009 order that they did on the 90-150 days, and that this is different than county's normal permit review process. The date starts at the first day of the application, regardless of whether it's complete or not. We have a certain period of time to tell the applicant that it's not complete, and that'll stop the clock, but then it won't restart. You know, it'll continue. If we tell the applicant in 10 days that your application is not complete, then we wait for the applicant to give information, you're starting at day 11. So in our normal land use process, it starts over. So that's something that is a reason why we couldn't go with our land use procedures ordinance in 2104, just straight with this wireless code. We had to pick and choose what could be used, because we have to use FCC timing. So then this year, there was a big change where another carve out of that the FCC did for small wireless facilities. So this is not new, and it's a version of that is partially new, partially co-location, but they're smaller facilities. So we have another item to consider in all this complication. Fortunately, the FCC did define what a small wireless facility is, so that's pretty set. And they said in this last order, there's three areas that they covered: the period of review, fees that can be charged, which won't really impact the ordinance that you're going to review, and then essentially all other regulations, focusing on aesthetics, but applies to anything else. So for this period of review, new small wireless facilities get 90 days. That's similar to the other one. Co-located gets 60 days. Again, first day of application starts the clock running. But in this one, they allowed, when we tell the applicant that the information is not complete, that tolls the clock, but then it restarts the first time we get information back. After that, it doesn't. So there's just a lot of complications. So when you read through the code, that's the reason for some of that oddity. In the last presentation, you heard about sometimes there'll be 10 to 30 or 20 applications set at a particular period of time. So they're small, they want to go in an area. The FCC said we cannot disallow batching. We have to allow them to put in all, you know, whatever they want at the same time. And that whole batch still gets the 60 days. There is some wiggle room if we reasonably believe it'll take resources away from doing other things, and that gets a little complicated. So, but their theory was if all those permits came in individually, they'd still get the 60 days. So the batching is something that we can't prohibit. Everything on that. And then fees, just briefly, so you've got the background, we don't have to deal with it in the ordinance. They have to be published in advance, non-discriminatory among the providers, and they have to be objectively reasonable approximations of actual cost. That's really nothing new for the county, because we've got state law that limits us anyways. They did provide presumptively reasonable dollar figures for one-time fees, which apply not only to land use codes and land use permits, but building permits, right-of-way permits, and everything like that. There's one fee. And then reoccurring fees for like our roads department, right-of-way, use of the right-of-way, there's certain fees for that. So it's pretty restrictive there. And finally, all other types of regulations, including aesthetics, it's very general, but we need to make sure we're meeting these. Published in advance, which this ordinance will do. They need to be non-discriminatory against, across the providers, objectively reasonable, and then no more burdensome than other wireless type of infrastructure. And remember, this is for the small wireless facilities. Not, there could be the co-locations and the other co-locations that are not small wireless, but may substantially modify. And so We have to take all those into account. And Darren will talk about this slide. Helps outline some of those 60, 90, 150-day time frames.
Thank you, Lisa. First of all, were there any questions for Lisa before I went on to the slide? I know there's a lot of material that's coming at you tonight, so if you do have questions that you want to submit to me through emails, either through Amanda or Robin here, we can get those questions and then answer those at the next session as well. So this slide is just an example of trying to take all of those FCC rulings that you saw just now and putting them into a table. This is an example from the preliminary draft code. This could change as a result of early feedback, but this is how we're trying to distill that information into something that is understandable. So when we go through the code, you see the 60, 90 days, and then the permissibility of what we're talking about for what kind of permit you're going to need. We go through the detail of letter of exemptions. And it's primarily broken up into, you know, things that are co-located versus what is a new facility and structure. And it also is in the context of what's small wireless facility versus the other facilities that we were talking about. So, in terms of the extremely dense information, we are at our end for this evening for that. As a reminder, our next meeting is on January 8th. That is another work study that is for our staff report and proposed code. Again, this this presentation tonight with video and audio recording is going to be available on our code update webpage through a link that we provide. Hopefully we'll get that by tomorrow. It may be a couple of days. And if anybody needs any specific questions answered through me, I am the project lead and a planner at Kitsap County. My contact information is available on the last slide. And I guess I will turn it over to the Planning Commission if you have questions.
I just had a quick comment. That was really appreciated the podcast stuff you sent along. I thought that was really helpful in terms of giving some context to what we were doing, so thank you for that.
Great. And to the commissioner's comment there, we forwarded two podcasts on to the Planning Commission through an email. We plan to make those links available on the website as well for the public to view.
During the testimony, we had a study, the Wallace Consortium.
Let me correct. It was not testimony for tonight, but right, during the presentation, yes.
Information.
So the Ogden Wallace.
Can we get access to that?
I will see what I can do on pulling together. We do have model ordinances that are through the industry and through planning resources. We have the model ordinances I believe they're talking about, but I'd have to confirm that. But I'll look into that
consortium
group effort. Yes.
Right.
Okay. Any further questions?
Okay. Thank
you. I do want to thank the carriers, Verizon, AT&T, T-Mobile, and Sprint for their time and putting on this educational piece for us. This is a very difficult code to get through, and it really helps to have that technical expertise. Also want to thank Lisa Nickel for her expertise in our our law backgrounds here. So thank you.
So, Mr. Bolger, do you have any updates for us?
Good evening. Jim Bolger, Department of Community Development. I don't really have any major administrative updates for you this evening, and that, I guess, is kind of the update. I will give you a little bit of the latest news. Some of you may have been contacted by our Human Resources Department and have been asked to participate in a number of focus groups that have been convened around the county to look at the leadership of the department with the resignation of Director Garbo, and so I think there's one more of those sessions that are planned, so if you haven't had a chance to kind of weigh in on that, given your role as an advisory group to the department, I think your perspectives would be really worthwhile in terms of what kind of support you would be looking for from the department going forward and doing and fulfilling your responsibilities. My understanding is that there'll be a report out to the commissioners by the Director of Human Resources in early January. I think that'll be an interesting report, regardless of what the Board of County Commissioners chooses to do from there. I think it'll be valuable to hear what kind of the stakeholders in the community feel about the department, so I'm looking forward to that. Other than that, I'll just give you an update because it's on everybody's mind, the tornado in Port Orchard. I've been getting updates from the various first responder agencies. Apparently it was an category F2, which is rated as a 100 to 135 mile an hour winds. People from approximately 80 homes have been evacuated either because of damage or gas leaks. The search and rescue crews are waiting to go in until the gas leaks have been secured. So Cascade Natural Gas is on site trying to get those under control, at least at the beginning of the meeting. I haven't heard any updates since then. They have opened a Red Cross shelter at St. Gabriel's Church here in Port Orchard. So if anybody's displaced because of this, and apparently the tornado touched down kind of in the Walmart vicinity on Bethel and then moved over towards the Jackson Lund Regional Park. So it probably went maybe a mile at the most, not even, probably half mile more or so. It was the Harrison neighborhood in Port Orchard, if you're familiar with the area, that was probably the hardest hit by it. So more information to come as light comes and more responders get onto the site. So that's all I have. Happy to answer any questions.
All right.
If none, happy holidays, everybody. We'll see you after the new year, I guess.
Do we have anything else for the good of the order before we adjourn tonight? Nope. It's the last meeting for the year. So, yes, we will all reconvene next year.
You did? Okay.
Bingo.